Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books and Religion on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I will be your host today. I'm speaking with Dr. Megan Goodwin, Visiting Lecturer of Religion at Northeastern University. She is Program Director for Sacred Rites, a Henry Luce Foundation-funded program hosted by Northeastern University that promotes public scholarship on religion, and with Elise Morgenstein First, co-host of Keeping It 101, a Killjoy's Introduction to Religion podcast. We'll be speaking about her 2020 book, Abusing Religion: Literary Persecution, Sex Scandals, and American Minority Religions. Dr. Goodwin, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Great. So to begin with, could you talk a little bit about your research background and how this book kind of came about?
Sure. I went to grad school because I thought I was going to work on witches. turns out there are not a whole lot of jobs for people who work on witches, but jokes on me, there are not a whole lot of jobs, period. So I got to grad school and my advisor encouraged me to get to the root of the questions that I was trying to ask. Mm-hmm. And the project emerged around questions of where bad sex and bad religion overlap, and the way that we, in what's now the United States, use sex to regulate religion and we use religion to regulate sex, even and maybe especially in spaces that aren't overtly religious themselves. So spaces like courtrooms and public media, things like that.
And so just to define sort of the basic terms, right, how are minority religions classified in the United States? So what are we talking about when we say a minority religion?
So minority religion isn't a legal classification. It's my attempt to offer an alternative to something like a new religious movements, and which is not to say that like Islam is a new religious movement. It's been here for a minute. But I started my studies in the field of new religious movements. And the longer I was looking at groups that get called cults, the more I was realizing that the novelty of them, the newness, was the least interesting thing to me. So in new religious movement studies, we look at the Shakers as an NRM, right? They get started in the late 18th century. Nobody in NRMs talks about Mormonism, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or any of its offshoots as a new religious movement, despite the fact that it's younger than the Shakers. So something is going on there. Ultimately, I decided what I wanted to look at was where and how specific religions or strains of religions, so certain kinds of Christianity, get marginalized and on what terms. So when I'm looking at American minority religions, I'm looking at traditions that fall outside of legal protections, of public approval, of any sort of anything that gets qualified as a bad religion. And when we're talking about bad religion, we're looking at religions that aren't afforded the protection of, say, the First Amendment, right? If we are supposed to treat all religions equally, what are the religions that don't get treated equally if a person from that tradition is incarcerated or a group in that tradition decides they want to live near to but not in a town in Texas, for example, and want to practice a form of Christianity that makes space for communal living and apocalypticism and also polygamy, for example, and what happens legally and culturally when we try to do that religion differently.
And what your book really focuses on is the way that this kind of discourse, as you call it, of minoritization focuses on allegations of sexual predation as kind of the key or the main threat that it poses to American society. So why is that such a big focus?
Because Americans oversignify sex. We understand it as the most important thing about us. And obviously, it's never just sex. The way that we understand sex in the U.S. also has to do with gender and race and ability and economics and all of that. But we react in these huge, spectacular ways when we feel that sex is being done wrong. So the reason I wanted to focus on the space where sex gets used to minoritize religions is because sex is so effective at minoritizing religions. It's a space where we can say, oh, you're not just different, you're wrong, and therefore you must get out. Or, you know, have tanks sent into your front lawn, something like that.
Yeah, so it sort of serves as a proxy for all the kind of anxiety that comes along with what's perceived to be an outsider religion.
I mean, I'm not sure if it's a proxy so much as it is a... getting Foucauldian in my brain. It's a technology. It is a right, space right. Where we create folks who either do or do not fit into our idea of what a real, true, moral American is.
It really kind of zeroes in your book on the way that, you know, there's this kind of idea in American society that we have absolute religious freedom and anyone can practice the way they want. And yet this really highlights the way that religions that are accepted are expected to reinforce a certain standards of social behavior, for example.
Very much so. Yeah, this is a space where my students kind of always struggle because we start almost all of my classes by talking about what the constitutional protections for religion are and what's now in the United States. And we talk about disestablishment and we talk about free exercise. And they say, great, free exercise. That means as long as it's religious, you can do whatever you want. Like, oh no, you sweet summer children. It means not that at all. And it is interesting to me as someone who studies religion and sex and quote unquote new religions, that the space where we first define what free exercise is in what's now the United States is specifically around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the practice of polygamy. So it is around this different kind of Christianity, which gets understood as a different kind of whiteness. And the reason that it must be defined is because they are doing sex differently and quote unquote wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the narratives that you focus on in the book are what you describe as popular pulp nonfiction narratives.
Yes.
So what are those, first of all?
They're trash. Mm-hmm. They're garbage books. So they are books that get marketed to a general audience. So these are not textbooks. There are things that you would pick up in an airport that I always think of it as like things that would show up in my mom's book club. Right? Mm-hmm. Where regular folks who are not spending their entire early adulthood in classrooms would pick up these books and be titillated and intrigued by what feels like an insight, a like peek into a minoritized community. And the problem with books like Not Without My Daughter or Under the Banner of Heaven is that they present a really skewed portrait of minoritized traditions in what's now the U.S. And so the folks that read these books actually know less about like Mormonism or Islam than they did before they picked up the book.
I have to admit that I'm one of the people who was very much taken in by Under the Banner of Heaven when it first came out.
Yeah, this is the thing that's hard. Krakauer's a really good writer. Mm-hmm. He just, you know, didn't talk to any Mormon fundamentalist women who actually wanted to be part of the community. There's no space for them to speak in his book. He went into the book determined to show that Mormon fundamentalism and thus Mormonism and thus religion are dangerous and violent and irrational, and those are the voices that get to speak in his narrative. It's very compelling. It's just also crap.
Yeah. So of all the, I mean, there's so many of these, right? So how did you choose the ones that you focus on in the book?
Well, so I was looking at... I was looking at captivity narratives across the board when I was first pulling this book together, but I realized that what I wanted to focus on were captivity narratives that had demonstrable and trackable impact in the American religious, legal, cultural sphere. And I wanted to look at books that were looking specifically at traditions that have kind of always haunted the idea of America. So we were concerned about witches and Satan before there was even a United States. For as long as there have been Muslims and Mormons in what's now the United States, we have been very anxious about them. And those have been religious anxieties, those have been sexual anxieties, and those have been racial anxieties. So to look at the way that they have always sort of haunted the U.S. was really important to me. But also, there is a moment in American history where the idea of having the right kind of sex and having the right kind of morals, which gets stripped out of religiosity and just being the right kind of person, consolidates, and that's in the 1970s. So after Roe v. Wade, you have a huge... especially but not exclusively white Christian anxiety around losing the country, anxieties around abortion and contraception, around gay people insisting that they're people and we treat them like people, around women working out of the home. So there's a gendered and a sexed and also a raced anxiety in the 1970s. And we see an unprecedented confederacy of different kinds of Christianities coming together to arbitrate what kind of sex makes you a good American. So it is not a unique moment, but it is an important moment in American history. And so I wanted to look at books that emerge around the fault lines of American sex and American religion after 1979 and 1980.
And then you talk about this kind of fever pitch of paranoia around religious difference in the 80s with the Satanic Panic and so forth.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah. So another term that was really, I think, interesting and a perfect way to describe this is contraceptive nationalism, to describe the way that American religious outsiders are characterized as a sexual menace. Mm-hmm. So what does this entail? What's the stake in its reinforcement?
So when we're looking at contraceptive narratives, I can speak. When we're looking at contraceptive, when we're looking at contraceptive nationalism, this is a rhetorical device that tries to protect both white American women and children and the idea of America from infiltration, contamination, dare we say, insemination by religious and sexual outsiders. So the idea is to tell stories about what happens when we let religion and sex be too free. I mean, sure, freedom is all nice and good. America loves freedom. You know, America plus freedom equals BFF. But there are those who just happen to either be not Christian or Christian in the wrong way, who happen to be not white or white in the wrong way, who want to take advantage of our freedoms, these stories tell us. And what happens when we do not guard our freedoms is that our white women and children are sexually defiled, contaminated, preyed upon. So we're looking at any narrative that tries to protect the American body politic from insemination by religio-sexual predators so that we can maintain the integrity of America as, we're not saying this out loud, but a white Christian nation, or at least a nation that prioritizes specific kinds of Christianity and specific kinds of whiteness.
And this is a time you alluded to this before, that mainstream Christian denominations that didn't really get along so much before sort of start to form a coalition.
Yeah, the Catholic piece weirded me out, man. Yeah. So it's, if you don't work on American religious history, I think it's hard to get a sense of just how bizarre this moment is. But so for most of the history of what's now the United States, Roman Catholics have been religious outsiders, and they were minoritized, again, on these racial and sexual points. We have stories, even up to the 1960s, about physical and sexual abuse happening in Catholic schools, in monasteries, in convents, basically Catholics being not quite American, not quite white in the right way, and certainly of sexual danger to quote-unquote real Americans. This is as public as JFK being in front of a group of Southern Baptist ministers in 1960, telling them he's running for president and he promises if he gets elected, he's not going to let the Pope run the country. Like, there is a huge, very well-established anxiety around Roman Catholicism owing its true allegiance to the Pope and not to the U.S. And then suddenly, in the 1970s, and specifically in response to Roe v. Wade and the legalization of abortion, kind of, you see an alliance forming between many different kinds of Protestant Christianity, but also, and for the first time in American history, including Roman Catholicism. Not so many like Catholics. Catholics still not super welcome to sit with us, but Roman Catholic sexual morality as a way of articulating what American sexual value should look like. And that's interesting and super weird. Abortion historically had not been it had been understood in the U.S. as a Catholic issue. Different denominations, different Protestant denominations had different perspectives on it. Some were okay, some were not. Mostly they weren't talking about it. Contraception, overwhelmingly a Catholic issue. Many Protestant denominations in favor of contraception. Until this moment in the 1970s, where we see the moral majority and the new Christian right emerge, and suddenly you have folks who have spent their entire religious public career saying, oh, the Catholics are not like us, they are not real Americans, they can't sit with us, being like, you know what, they got it right. But only about sex. And that, again, is fascinating to me. So we are seeing, particularly Jerry Falwell and new Christian right folks, adopting Roman Catholic sexual values rhetoric, but not any Catholic rhetoric around the labor movement or nuclear disarmament or like the environment. It's only sex. And this is one of the spaces that made me really want to dig into stories like the ones in my book.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of contemporary Catholic politicians who are always banging the anti-abortion drum, and yet, God forbid, anybody mentions what the Catholics call the seamless garment approach, right? Which also has to do with the death penalty.
Yeah, why aren't we talking about Catholic perspectives on the death penalty? Why aren't those equally valid? Where is the Catholic social or the Catholic worker tradition in any of this? Not so much, but increasingly, since the 1970s, and certainly under George W. Bush, Catholic morality around sex becomes American morality. And that is fascinating and has only intensified. Truly, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has more political weight than it ever has. But we also see this being adopted and normalized as just kind of American values. And the case that I come back to always is Hobby Lobby, because the argument that contraception and abortion are basically the same thing is 100%, not just a Catholic argument, but is a Catholic argument under John Paul II. This is like very 1980s. We see Reagan engaging in this rhetoric a lot. But to have it codified by the Supreme Court of the United States in this Hobby Lobby case, where they're saying, okay, well, scientifically, no, but there is a sincerely held belief that contraception and abortion are the same thing. And so we have to honor that belief. And so these companies, which are privately held, don't have to adhere to the contraceptive mandate of the Affordable Care Act. It is wackadoo. And I don't know what to do with it except do a lot of yelling on the internet. So,
Yeah, and it makes me think, I mean, you mentioned that prior to Roe v. Wade, a lot of Protestants were pro-contraception. And
yeah.
I think it was last summer I did an interview with Melissa Wilde, who wrote a book about the history of the American contraceptive movement. Mm. And she talks about how one of the reasons that many Protestant churches supported contraception was actually because of this anxiety over this perceived Catholics having too many children, right? And mm-hmm. the Catholic side was very much anti-contraception. And then you get this coalition that starts to form in the 70s as a response to this perceived kind of liberalization of sexual morality.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah. And then this term that you use, which if you could talk a little bit more about that, is small c Christian.
So small c Christian is building on the work of folks like Winnie Sullivan and Tracy Fessenden, who are arguing that we normalize and naturalize and kind of strip the serial numbers off Protestant Christianity in what are supposed to be secular spaces. So Sullivan's work looks at it in the court systems, where you have judges adjudicating cases about religion based on their own personal understandings of religion, which just because specific kinds of white Christianity are like the air we breathe in the U.S., they are importing Christian assumptions about what religion looks like, what religious people should do, without even necessarily recognizing that they are Protestant assumptions. We see a similar argument in Love the Sin, which is Jacobson and Pellegrini. I freaking love this book. And they look at that specifically in Supreme Court cases around sex and sexuality and the way that Protestant understandings of what counts as religion and what doesn't smuggle in these Protestant assumptions. Fessenden looks at it in print culture. Lynn Gerber actually does some really great work around this in Seeking the Straight and Narrow. But what all of those definitions have in common are that they're looking at Protestantism in the absence of Catholic thought, values, culture. So as I was saying, in the 1970s, we see the importation of Catholic sensibilities around sex, again, arguably for the first time in this American moral discourse. So when we're thinking about the way that Christianity and Christian assumptions shape the American public sphere, I think it's important that we acknowledge that Catholicism is now a part of that, and specifically a part of that when we're thinking about what good sex looks like in America. So it's small c Christian rather than small p Protestant, because Catholics are helping shape this moral landscape.
I mean, this is something that's personally familiar to me because I'm from a minority religion to Judaism. Mm. And I mean, the extent to which sort of Protestant religious discourse shapes even the way that pretty much all non-Orthodox Jews in America, at least on some level, start to perceive their own religious tradition through this Protestant prism. It really is so powerful. And yet we don't always notice it unless it's pointed out like this.
Yeah. Well, and for non-Christian religions, it's often a survival strategy. Mm-hmm. If you want to be afforded the protections of quote unquote real religion, you have to look or at least approximate real religion, which just so happens to look like very specific kinds of white Christianity.
Right. Exactly. So you write in the introduction, not all stories about women are feminist stories. And you talk about how the religious sexual abuse narratives have been deployed to maintain a sort of a heteropatriarchal gender norm, and as well as white supremacy. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I would argue, for example, that like Not Without My Daughter is not a feminist story. This does not make space for the equality of people of all genders, right? Stories about strong women are often embraced, I think particularly by liberal white feminists, as feminist stories. I mean, Betty Mahmoudi, via like Sally Field's portrayal of her in the movie, became this like second wave feminist icon because she resisted an abusive partner and got out. And again, I only have Betty Mahmoudi's word for what happened to her. And I believe her that she underwent and survived abuse. The space where this story is not a feminist story is the space where every other woman in the book sucks. And particularly the Muslim women. All of the Muslim women have been brainwashed. There is no space for a woman to have decided that Islam is a good way for her to be in the world. Muslim equals bad, and that includes Muslim women. And there is no space for, in this like very Saba Mahmood inflected sort of way, there's no space for a negative agency for folks who have decided that what they want is to submit their lives to the will of God. That makes them, in Mahmoudi's telling, stupid and animalistic and violent and predatory in similar ways, although less overtly violent ways, than Muslim men.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in terms of the Not Without My Daughter, you wrote that this book had major, not only sort of after effects for the way that Muslims in the U.S. were perceived, but even foreign policy implications.
Yeah, Bill Clinton passed a friggin' law about international child abduction, and the only person he name checks in the bill is Betty Mahmoudi. It is unreal. You also have the movie even being entered as evidence in divorce proceedings, as evidence for why Muslim men should not have custody for their children. And it's particularly interesting because the more time I've spent around custody law in the U.S., I'm realizing that that myth of like, oh, women always get their kids is deeply untrue, particularly when there are allegations of abuse. If it is a white family where the woman is coming in and saying, my husband is abusing my child, by and large, statistically, the dad gets the kids. So for this story to emerge as a reason why Muslim men cannot be trusted with their children, again, has both religious and racial implications. It also ruined the dating lives of a number of Muslim men, as we know from the onlines.
I it's been many years since I saw the movie, but I went back before our interview and watched the trailer for Not Without My Daughter.
Sorry.
And
I'm so sorry.
No, but I was really struck by one of the parts of the trailer where they're showing all the harrowing scenes that are happening to Sally Field's character, yeah, interspersed with her having a Christian kind of prayer with her daughter. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. The implication certainly is that, well, Islam is oppressive and Christianity is liberatory.
It is, but it's funny. Both in the book, the trailer makes some choices, but both in the book and the movie, Betty Mahmoudi's religion is not emphasized at all. She like offhandedly mentions that I think she's Lutheran, but right, it comes up like once in the book. She is American, and access to contraception, interestingly, is an American right. It's like a very 1970s space, because mm-hmm. this book would have been very different written in the 90s. But that's actually where I started theorizing contraceptive nationalism, is there is a scene in Not Without My Daughter, not the movie, they did not film
right,
this.
No, of course.
But in the book, where Betty Mahmoudi is concerned that her husband, who's a medical doctor, is going to realize that she's had an IUD implanted, and she's worried that he's going to beat her to death. So she has this like vividly narrated scene of using the tweezers from her manicure kit to remove her IUD while she's locked in the bathroom, yeah, where the Muslim masculinity, the way that she's described it, is basically forcing her to sexually violate herself to stay alive. It is incredibly violent and incredibly gory. does not at all map onto my experiences of having an IUD removed, but you know, every person's body is different. But the way that she talks about herself personally being violated, but also her entitlement to bodily autonomy, to reproductive technologies that should let her decide whether or not she wants to get pregnant, as an American, was fascinating to me because it wasn't a religious argument. It wasn't like, oh, my denomination says this is okay. This is a thing that American women should be entitled to, that her husband, her Muslim, brown, violent, rapey husband, is forcing her to strip from her own body. And that's how these kinds of stories normalize specific kind of Christian understandings of what it is to be American without naming them as American. Specific kinds of Christianity with and naming them as Christian. Like, again, Mahmoudi is never falling back on this is my right as a Christian. It's always this is my right as an American. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. It's fascinating to kind of look back and think that for the positive is that this idea that women are entitled to contraceptive or bodily autonomy is not something that we would see if this story were told today from an American perspective.
No, it's really jarring, honestly. And she talks about contraception all the time in the book because she starts stealing pills from her husband as well. But it really is just like, this is what Americans get. Like, we get the pill. I think it's also a space where I think a lot of folks don't realize how new access to contraception was for American women, right? Like Griswold v. Connecticut is 1965. That's for married couples. Yep. The decision for single women, I think, is 67 or 68. So this is only like 10, 15 years tops, but it is an entitlement the way that she's talking about it. So to see that reversed in my lifetime is pretty trippy.
Yeah. So speaking of the violent and the gory, can we talk a little bit about Michelle Remembers?
Sure. Yes, we can. Wow. What do you want to talk about?
So, I mean, could you give a little bit of background on what the book is for, you know, listeners who haven't heard about it?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. This is a book that comes out in 1980. It is published by a Canadian psychiatrist and his patient who later becomes his wife. He has, he says, helped her recover memories of being ritually abused by a satanic coven that included her mother. They kidnapped her. They physically and sexually assaulted her. They terrified her. And through divine intervention, literally in the story, the Virgin Mary shows up. Michelle is able to reject Satan and stay safe and grow up. But the memories are emerging, they realize, because Satan is again a pressing threat. And so they need to spread this story in order to prepare the world for this new satanic onslaught, which doesn't sound like something that would have been published in a nonfiction space, but it was. It was published with the imprimatur of the Bishop of British Columbia, I believe, of Remy DeRue. And Smith and Pazder went on the road, not just to promote the book itself, but as experts in recovered memories, in, interestingly, multiple personality disorder, which we'd now call dissociative identity disorder, despite the fact that Michelle did not have multiple personalities, and in satanic ritual abuse. So when I say that they're on the road as experts, I mean they are giving seminars that people pay to go to. They're showing up at the American Psychiatric Association's national meeting. They are convening workshops for law enforcement and social workers saying this is what satanic ritual abuse looks like. It is happening. It's happening everywhere. You have to be on the lookout for it. And here's how you know what to look for. So they're providing basically a script for identifying satanic ritual abuse. And what we then see is in both court cases where Pazder and Smith are consulting, or in spaces where someone involved in a legal case or a social work case or a mental health case have been exposed to this material, they are identifying satanic ritual abuse in daycares or in people's pasts or in violent crimes. And everyone starts telling a very similar story because they're all working from the same source material. So most scholars identify the publication, and I will use this word again, deliberately, dissemination of Michelle Remembers as the beginning of the Satanic Panic, which is like a decade plus long period of public anxiety and laws get passed, people go to jail, lives are ruined around the idea that there is a global satanic conspiracy that is preying on white women and children. And it's very mainstream. It's I think if you didn't live through it, it's hard to get a sense of how mainstream it was, but like this is showing up on 2020 and Geraldo, which, like, yes, Geraldo's a joke now, but that program, which, by the way, you had to watch in real time because that's how TV worked in the 80s, 20 million viewers, 13.5 million viewers showed up for the 2020 piece in 1985. And Jesse Helms, about whom I will say no more, entered the transcript of that 2020 episode into the Congressional Record of the United States as evidence for his motion to deny tax-exempt status to any organizations that trafficked with evil spirits. That's a direct quote.
Oh, wow.
Or the powers of the devil. And it passed unanimously. The entire Senate of the United States of America in the year of someone's Lord, 1985, said, "You're right, Jesse Helms. We shouldn't give tax breaks to witches."
Yeah, I mean, it really feels like anytime I read about the Satanic Panic, it feels like I'm reading about something that happened 500 years ago. It's amazing that this is in our lifetime.
And yeah. I mean, and QAnon is pulling a lot of the same levers. Yeah, so
exactly,
that's happening. Yeah.
I mean, in terms of Michelle Remembers, there's this podcast called You're Wrong About did a great, mm-hmm. I think, 4-part series on this. And one of the hosts talks about how, to a certain extent, it never really ended. It's just taken a new form with QAnon.
That's accurate. Yeah. Sarah Marshall. Yeah. We follow each other on Twitter. Sarah Marshall's writing a book about the Satanic Panic now. Yes. So yeah, there is a renewed interest in the podcast sphere around these issues. And yeah, QAnon has done a lot to kick that up as well.
Yeah, and we should say there was absolutely no proof at all, and all signs point to Michelle Remembers being completely fabricated or imagined, as the case may be.
Yeah, it's not just that there's no evidence, there's counter evidence in the case of Michelle Remembers. So there are pictures of her being at school while she was allegedly abducted. There, you know, are no reports of the kind of car crashes that she reports surviving. She, in the book, says that she had never heard about Christianity before. Her entire birth family is Catholic. She went to parochial school. So that doesn't sync up. We also now know that the kind of techniques Pazder and other mental health professionals were using to quote unquote recover memories actually create memories. Human memory is a lot more malleable than a lot of folks realize. And so women diagnosed, and it was overwhelmingly white women, diagnosed as satanic ritual abuse survivors have these memories of things happening to them that there is no corroborative evidence for, which is a hard thing to say to someone who in all likelihood probably did survive some form of sexual trauma. Right. And in a broader scale, the Federal Bureau of Investigation spent something like 7 years and $750,000 of the taxpayers' money trying to find forensic evidence of satanic ritual abuse. And the investigator Ken Lanning published in January 1992, and said, "Yeah, no, we looked. We really looked. We can't find anything. And we're worried that more mundane instances of child sex abuse are being ignored or overlooked or pushed to the side because they don't have this kind of spectacular element to them."
That's exactly. I mean, I always think that, you know, people get so hung up on these kind of incredible stories of satanic ritual abuse because they don't want to confront the fact that most child sexual abuse is happening in someone's household, in your neighborhood, in your church, in your school. It's not this kind of sensationalized thing.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that's, that is the argument of the book, is that abuse happens because we let it happen. It happens everywhere. And the cases that I'm pulling out are spaces where stories about abuse did actually inspire action, which is very rare. And it inspires this over-the-top, spectacular, performative reaction because it lets us pretend that we are not complicit in child sex abuse or in sex abuse broadly, right? It's someone else's problem. It is a monster. We would never be those people. And if we treat this one isolated incident that just keeps happening over and over again, if we just do this one thing, then we will have fixed it. And then we have gotten rid of the monstrous problem that is not who we are. And as you're saying, it is exactly who we are. Abuse happens in our homes, in our communities. It happens at the hands of people we know and love and trust. And until we can acknowledge that, we can't do anything to disrupt or prevent child sex abuse or sexual violence.
Exactly. And I mean, as we all know now, all of this time with the Catholic Church was one of the biggest perpetrators of this.
Very much so. And that is another space of disjuncture for me. And it's where I end the book, because we have very clear evidence, not just that clergy were participating in child sex abuse, but that the magisterium, the mechanisms of the Roman Catholic Church in the US and beyond knew about the abuse that was happening and let it keep happening rather than say, we need to take responsibility for this. This keeps happening because we let it keep happening. So priests, even that got caught in Boston, rather than being defrocked, were moved to the American Southwest, where they were allowed to abuse Native and Latinx kids with impunity for decades. Mm-hmm. And the space of tension that I wanted to sit in as I was closing the book is, one, this is happening while Roman Catholic theology is becoming the arbiter for American sexual morality, right? So you have then Bishop Bernard Law delivering very public speeches about the sanctity of the lives of children as a way to argue against contraception and abortion while covering up massive institutionalized sex abuse within the Catholic Church. But also, if we look at something like the FLDS case that I look at, this was a community that's relatively small. One report of sex abuse was enough to bring in dozens of law enforcement agencies and, again, armored personnel vehicles. The largest custodial seizure of children in American history, more than 400 kids were taken at one time because the state of Texas treated it as one household. And to get their kids back, every single adult living at Yearning for Zion, the FLDS ranch, had to register as a sex offender, not because they themselves had personally harmed children, but because they allowed their kids to live at Yearning for Zion where abuse had happened. And abuse did happen at Yearning for Zion. It happened statistically less than we would expect in a community of that size, but that is not in any way to excuse abuse. Abuse is wrong and should be addressed and prevented wherever we can. At the same time, we know massive sexual abuse was being perpetrated and covered up within the Roman Catholic Church. And no one is sending tanks into parish parking lots on Sunday. No one is forcing Roman Catholic parents to register as sex offenders for letting their kids be altar servers, right? So the space I want us to really look at is, where do we draw these lines of minoritization? How do we use sex to reinforce what kind of religion is acceptable? And then also sit with us, like, we've decided that a certain amount of sex abuse, I guess, is fine as long as the religion is big enough and normal enough and white enough. Because yes, there have been some important disclosures of information around Roman Catholic sex abuse, certainly the Pennsylvania Commission being one of the most recent and largest. But we had known for at least 20 years that this kind of abuse was happening in Boston and in other places. And none of the states, even Pennsylvania, which is the most actively litigious around this, have done very much to change the statute of limitations, to lobby any sort of criminal or financial penalties. Like, yes, there have been some payouts, but also the Roman Catholic Church is not hurting for money. There has been no political censure, again, of Roman Catholic officials. There have been no political consequences for Roman Catholic authorities. Again, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is more influential politically than it has ever been in the history of the U.S. So as a country, as a political governing body, we have basically decided, like, that's bad, but not bad enough to actually either punish you for or actively try to prevent moving forward.
Yeah, you know, I just thought of this now, but there's another kind of minority religious community that has very high rates of abuse, which is the Amish community. Mm. And yet there's a certain perception, I think, in the United States that sort of a, what's the word I'm looking for, idealization of the Amish and this kind mm-hmm. of simplicity. So it's almost taboo to bring that up.
Yeah, I am certainly not an expert in this area, but there are a lot of spaces where we just kind of turn a blind eye. And the spaces that I'm particularly thinking of are instances of abuse that happen in Black churches, instances of abuse that happening in like mm-hmm. International Society for Krishna Consciousness, better known as Hare Krishnas, right? There are mm-hmm. spaces where we've decided that like, meh, it's not our business. And we don't have to care about those kids, or we don't have to care about those people. And so, yeah, the drawing of lines around whose sex abuse is a spectacular crime that we have to abject from the national body versus whose sex abuse is like, oh, well, that happens. Let's keep trucking, is really interesting.
Do you get the sense with the under the banner of heaven and this kind of demonization of the FLDS, has that had any impact on the way that the mainstream LDS church has been perceived?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they have been, okay, so I want to say out loud too that Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not consider anyone but themselves as legitimately Mormon. I know you know, but listeners might not. Mm-hmm. But LDS has for decades been really working on its public image as mainstream Christian, as very white, despite the fact that most of their converts are not white at this point, and quintessentially American. So the kind of specter of polygamy is something that they do an awful lot of work to try to distance themselves from. And so an FLDS or the Kingstons or even like a sister wives space pops up, there's a lot of work in the Mormon PR machine to explain why and how this is not Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But I mean, again, we saw this even when Mitt Romney was running for president, whichever mm-hmm. time, as folks wanted to talk a lot about his relatives that moved to Mexico in part to continue living the principle of plural marriage. So it is still very much something that Mormons who are in the public sphere are pushing back against and saying, no, that's not us. And that impulse to say, no, that's not us is one that I find really important, because we're not rejecting the premises on which groups get minoritized. We're just trying to put ourselves on the right side of that line. Right? Roman Catholics did this. Roman Catholics did not say, you should not tell Americans how they should be having sex or where they should fit racially. I thought this was a country that made space for everybody. The argument is, no, we are doing sex right. We are the right kind of white. You're right to draw that line. You're just wrong about where we fit on this scale. And we see the same thing for a lot of newer kinds of religion too. Laura Vance actually has a great article about the ways that LDS and Seventh-day Adventists really doubled down on homophobia as they became closer to the American religious mainstream. So spaces where we use sexual intolerance of difference to establish ourselves and our tradition as right, as normal, as American.
So as we kind of get towards the end of our interview, what do you hope will be the key takeaways of your book for readers?
Oh, is that all? Well, I think it's important that we know that anytime we're talking about sex in what's now the United States, we're also talking about religion, even if those spaces aren't overtly religious. So just because someone's not saying, well, I'm Christian and here's how you should have sex, doesn't mean that Christianity isn't playing a role in how we understand what moral or right or correct or American sex looks like. Same thing with religion. Our understandings of religion are inflected by Christianity, whether we realize it or not. So on the podcast, we always say religion is not done with you, whether or not you're done with religion. So yeah, I think that is the big takeaway. There's also a space where I'm hoping that folks pay attention to, honestly, even crap media as spaces where right kinds of sex, right kind of religion, right kinds of nationalism get negotiated. So I think it's easy to blow off an Under the Banner of Heaven as like a stupid ahistorical book, or Not Without My Daughter as like a dumb movie that Sally Field did a while ago. People read these books, they watch these movies, and they take them really seriously, whether or not scholars do. So it's my hope that scholars will also start taking seriously the seemingly unserious media that truly does help shape opinions in really lasting and tenacious ways around how religion, sexuality, and nationalism work.
Oh, can you talk a bit about your current project?
Oh, yeah. It is called Cults Incorporated. I have spent most of my professional life trying not to write a book about cults, and I finally gave up. I quit. America wins. You win, America. I'm writing the cults book. And what happened was that in the past 5 years, but truly in the last 8 to 12 months, there has been an intensification of cult discourse in public. So wanting to talk about QAnon as a cult, wanting to talk about the 45th president as like Jim Jones, that was trending on Twitter for a while. Here's why it's a cult. Here's why it's not a cult. Here's why Republicanism is a cult. It's not a cult. And I have had it. I'm done. So, and the reason that this is so infuriating for me is, one, people get the history wrong. We misremember what happened at Jonestown. We misremember what happened with the MOVE bombing, if we remember that the MOVE bombing happened at all. But over and above that, I don't want it to just be a fact-checking project. What I want is to look at who profits when we get this stuff wrong. So what do we gain by misremembering Jonestown? What happens when we don't talk about MOVE as a religious movement? Does that make it okay to, I don't know, steal the corpses of their murdered children so that we can use them in Coursera classes at friggin' Princeton and Penn, which is a thing that happened?
Yeah.
What are the fundraising benefits of calling QAnon a cult? Right. For conservative folks who find the Q narrative compelling, right, they are using drinking the Kool-Aid as a test of loyalty as, yes, this is it. But also on liberal sides are like, oh, look at the crazies. They are religious and they'll believe anything and give us money so we can fix this. We don't have to pay attention to the filibuster. Don't worry about it. Just give us some more money. Or the spaces where law enforcement throws money at like responding to cults in ways that just don't happen anymore. I am haunted. There was a clip on John Oliver this year of federal law enforcement training to like infiltrate a cult compound, as though a compound of white people stockpiling guns would even like raise an eyebrow for federal law enforcement anymore. Like, what the hell, man? So who's profiting off this idea of cults? And what happens when we as a country just kind of say like, yeah, some religions are crazy. Like if you take religion too far, it's just nuts. And similar questions to what I'm asking in Amusing Religion, except that I'm spending more time specifically on the commodification and the profit motive of marginalizing and minoritizing groups that don't fit into a good religion mold.
That's very important, very timely. So I will look forward to reading that as well. Yeah. So where can our listeners find you online?
The answer is always Twitter. It's just Twitter. It's too often it's Twitter. So I am MPGPhD on Twitter. I also have a website, which is Megan-Goodwin.com. But yeah, this is the short answer is Twitter.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you for listening to New Books in Religion. I've been speaking with Dr. Megan Goodwin about abusing religion, literary persecution, sex scandals, and American minority religions, which is now available from Rutgers University Press. Dr. Goodwin, thank you again for joining me. It's such a fascinating topic, and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Thanks so much for chatting with me.